When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Oh, we're in for a long one. A long weekend, that is. And you deserve to spend it on the couch with a glass of something good. Luckily, there's Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery. With Drizly, you can compare prices on the biggest selection of beer, wine, and spirits, then get them delivered quickly. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's DRIZLY.com today.
If you're looking to get a new car, you could really cut expenses by bundling your car and renter's insurance with Progressive. Sure, you love your old car, but you know it's not normal to give instructions on how to open the window. It should be self-explanatory, but it's not. And notice how when you're in other people's cars, you can feel cushion in the seats? That's pretty nice, right? No, it's just normal. So bundle your renter's and car insurance with Progressive and put the savings toward a new car. It's time. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company coverage provided in service by affiliates and third-party insurers.
In the stores around my way, never on the beach, always out of reach, looking for a record to play. Hit records, you know darn well. Hit records, hey, I'm me under the spell. Hit records, I bite you wanna find. I can't get them out of my mind.
On this episode, we're going to hear from two members of the classic mid-70s pub rock band The Kursal Flyers, Graham Douglas and Will Birch, who each went on after the Kursals to make power pop history. Douglas with Eddie and the Hot Rods, for whom he wrote the UK top 10 hit Do Anything You Wanna Do, released in July of 1977, and Birch with The Records, whose single Starry Eyes almost made the top 40 in the US in 1979. The Records were formed in 1977 by Birch and singer-guitarist John Wicks, who had basically taken Graham Douglas's place in the last version of the Kursal Flyers. The Records released three albums between 1979 and 1982. Graham Douglas made two excellent albums with Eddie and the Hot Rods, Life on the Line and Thriller. Let's hear what they have to say about the roles that they played in power pop history.
Basically, in the Kursals, we started off as a English version of Flying Burrito Brothers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did a tour or two. Actually, we did a European tour with them. And, you know, at the time, we were, our genre was country rock, really. Trouble was that the countryside of it became a little bit overtaken by our first hit single, Little Deschino. Mm-hmm. That was going too pop for my taste, because I was unwilling to go full Top of the Pops there, full Silly Suits and stuff like that. I always wanted to be, my influences were always rock, country rock, and, you know, R&B. I was never really that involved with trying to be a pop band. I mean, those sorts of songs were my favourite songs. those were the sorts of songs that I wanted to write. I was always trying to toughen up the Kurzels to try and be a little bit heavier than a country band. When we did the tour with Flying Burrito Brothers, I mean, I loved them when they had Gram Parsons, because Gram Parsons to me was somebody who was eclectic, and I've always tried to be eclectic in my songwriting. The way I write songs is that I write a song and try and aim it at a certain field, a certain style of music that I particularly like. I mean, I can write, you know, folk. I can write R&B. I can write, you know, straight. I can even write one or two reggae tunes, but I mean, that's not my genre, really. I'm happy when I write eclectic songs that appeal to, you know, quite a lot of people. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, the first Kurzels album, one or two of the songs that I liked that I was trying to make heavier were things like Pocket Money. You know, Pocket Money, for example, was something that I thought, can I make this so that the Jay Giles Band would do it? Because Jay Giles Band were one of my favourites as well. So I'm always a bit crossover. I don't want to be a country. Don't want to be R&B. Don't want to be pop. I'm a bit of a rocker to start with. I want to keep the hardness to it, and you know, the dance aspect to it as well. I mean, when I grew up, you know, we would go to church youth club dances and youth club dances, and the ones that I wanted to dance to were the fast ones. I also like dancing to the Tamla songs as well. I mean, I was always a great fan of Otis and those sorts of dance songs. So I've always been open to all sorts of influences. If we want to talk influences, Do Anything You Want to Do was borrowed from the feel of the East Street Band. Bruce Springsteen has been a major influence on me, and I've always respected his way of trying to write songs that appeal to, you know, not rock songs, not pop songs, not any sort of label type of. I mean, you know, the East Street Band are a fucking great band. I can't think of a better band in terms of how to play for 3 hours and make the audience want 3 hours more. How they do it is beyond me. But, I've managed to see them a couple of times and walked out of the concert sort of drained, because they've given me the energy to actually sit there and jump up and down. Other influences, Grateful Dead. I mean, Grateful Dead have been, you know, magic to me. I mean, the way they've combined all sorts of influences and made it their own. Jerry Garcia's guitar playing, I've always tried to pick his melodic style and play melodically as well in his style, really. I mean, I've also tried to simplify. Jay Giles, for example, doesn't play flash solos, but he plays what the song needs. The song almost defines the guitar to a certain extent. When I first joined the Hot Rods, I was given, you know, Ed Hollis told me, take it away from Essex R&B and Dr. Feelgood and give it something more. So he wrote a couple of lines of lyrics of stuff that sounded like the MC5 and the Stooges. And I had a basis of where he wanted the Hot Rods to go. So on Life on the Line, I tried my best to write melodic rock that was dancing, you know, you could jump up and down to. And from, you know, from Charles Shaw Murray, thought that was the beginning of power pop. You know, I'll go along with it. I was trying to make it available to not only, I mean, the Hot Rods had a lot of female fans, basically because they had a pretty lead singer, and he was a very good front man. And he had lots of female fans. I mean, I wanted to write songs that weren't just boy songs, but they were rock songs that were available to, you know, girls as well. To a certain extent, I hoped that, you know, what I turned out for Life on the Line was approaching that sort of area. I mean, Dave Higgs, who actually wanted me to join the band because he was finding it very, very difficult to come up with more songs along the lines of, you know, the first Teenage Depression album, he convinced Ed Hollis to offer me the job. You know, I'm on Life on the Line, I mean, the best song on that, to my mind, is Beginning of the End. One of the songs I love playing, and one of his best ever songs. But I mean, he was a bit drained after that. He didn't much like touring. He didn't much like the Top of the Pop style either. But, you know, there you go. This is what had to be done in those days, at that time.
You're gone. So Kersal Flyers and Eddie and the Hot Rods were both basically part of what has come to be called the pub rock scene, right? And you already mentioned like Dr. Feelgood. And that the pub rock scene seems like it kind of laid the groundwork for punk and new wave. And a lot of people from the pub rock bands ended up in punk and new wave bands. And so, you know, especially people outside of the UK, I don't think a lot of people even understand that there was this whole pub rock scene that was really big, and that really was the beginning of punk and new wave in a lot of ways. And so even the Kersals, after you left, kind of tried to, you know, Television Generation was kind of trying to be a punk rock song, right? Did it, when you joined Eddie and the Hot Rods, I mean, Teenage Depression is obviously considered kind of an early punk song in a lot of ways. Was it like, so where was the punk scene at when you joined Eddie and the Hot Rods? Was it much of a thing yet? And was it like you were joining a punk band? Was that the direction that they were looking at going in, or?
I think if we go back to pub rock, I mean, pub rock was basically what you would understand as bar bands music. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, everybody learns their craft by playing to, you know, 20 people to start with, and then 150 people in a bar, and then maybe 500 people in a bar. But I mean, in London especially, which is where the pub scene started, they were all small bars. I mean, you could just about cram in 250 people if you were lucky. So they weren't even as big as bar bands or bars as you would understand it, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of different styles of music played in the pubs. I mean, there was like every from about 73 to 73 onwards, there would be about, I don't know, 50 different bars, 50 different pubs in the London area, which had bands playing. Some of them were charged to get in so that the bands could actually earn some money. Some of them were the landlord would pay the band 20 quid just to play, just so he could sell some beer. But I mean, this was small. Who started off them? I mean, it was one of the American bands, I think, Eggs Over Easy. Mm-hmm. They were probably the progenitors of the band, of the pub rock. And then there was Brinsley Swartz. There was Ace was another one. Chilly Willy, Ducks Deluxe. They predated the Kersals by a little bit. I mean, we started to play in the London pubs just about at the height of the popularity of the pub rock thing. Would have been about 74, I would think. Mm-hmm.
So was it surprising when Do Anything You Want to Do was a top 10 hit?
Once we recorded it, I mean, I was pretty convinced that it was a hit song as soon as we'd put down the backing track, because it had a rhythm, it had a feel, and you know, once Barry put on his vocal, all it needed was me to put on 50 million guitars and it was there. And I think the record company absolutely loved it. As soon as we played it to them, a rough mix, they said, we like this. This is a killer one. So, you know, we were quite happy about that. we did a little run at the Marquee, which was a great club to play. Everybody's played the Marquee, and we did a week there. And I think by the end of it, the song was starting to hit the charts.
Well, the whole look of the album does help kind of place it in the punk rock era, even though there are punk elements, but it's just a great 70s rock album to me.
I think we actually played a little bit with the Ramones, and done a couple of tours, couple of shows with the Ramones and in France. They came up to us afterwards and said, how do you play so many chords so fast? And I mean, Dee Dee was great. I got on well with Dee Dee. He was a lovely guy. And I said, but that's what you do when you play fast. And he said, I can't think of more than three chords at that speed. And I said, well, practice hard and you'll get it. And I think one or two of their future albums, they had four chords, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think, you know, we got on well with them, and we liked them a lot. They were a good bunch of good guys. As you say, punk and pub rock were almost synonymous, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talked about Bruce Springsteen. I remember reading about Joe Strummer saw Springsteen in 75, and, well, he wasn't even Joe Strummer yet. I think he was still Woody. But I remember he was very inspired by seeing Springsteen to completely change the way he performed. And I don't think a average person would think of Bruce Springsteen as being influential on punk rock, but here, you know, I know that he was influential on Joe Strummer, and you're saying he was very influential on you. And you can hear that in pub rock, it's very similar, a lot of very similar styles.
Yeah, Springsteen writes simple songs. I mean, they're not complicated songs. I mean, they feel like he's just opened his cupboard and, you know, pulled out a song that's been there for forever. He writes timeless songs, and whatever he writes for people. I mean, I've tried my best to try and to emulate that. I've never been a great lyricist in the same way that he appeals to a great majority of people, but I can do the music. My lyrics need a little bit more polish, but I try hard.
So when you were following up Life on the Line, was there a lot of pressure to follow it up with something good, with something great, and to have another hit album?
Yeah, the problem was that once we finished Life on the Line, we did about a year's solid touring.
Mm-hmm.
And we had no opportunity to write any songs. During the time we were touring with Life on the Line, we had our manager, which was Ed Hollis. He'd managed to decide he didn't really like touring anymore, so he wanted to be a producer full time. So he managed to convince Island Records, our label, to fund his little experimental label. The problem was that with that was that the funding that Ireland allowed him was to come out of the Hot Rod royalties, which we didn't know about at the time. We were totally naive about all this. So when we came round to doing, which was a year later, after we'd decided, the record company decided, hey, we need a new record. We need another hit single. I mean, they tried to milk Life on the Line through sticking out two more singles from the Life on the Line genre, you know, Quit This Town and Life on the Line itself. We were short of songs, and we had a bit of a problem with inspiration. Island had signed a distribution deal with EMI and allowed us the use of Abbey Road. Now, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
If you can think of trying to record Eddie and the Hot Rods in Abbey Road, was like, I mean, we walked through the door and our jaws dropped, because in the next studio was Paul McCartney, and he was wonderful. I mean, he came in more than once. Occasion, and we were trying to record Power and the Glory, which was probably the standout song on that album, and he was saying, yeah, I like this song, it's a love song, isn't it? And I was saying, Paul, it's a political song. And he said, nah, can't see it. It's a love song. Tell you what, Linda will sing on it. That's what you need. So he had Linda singing back up on it, which was lovely. We got on well with Paul and Linda. They were wonderful to us. We didn't have that many great songs on that album. We had maybe two or three good songs. I still think Pound the Glory was a hit single. At the time it came out, the scene in London was hardcore punk. And to a certain extent, we didn't have the hardcore punk credentials anymore. We'd missed the boat. Also, we'd missed the boat by not touring back in the States. I mean, we should have, because for our first UK, US tour was pretty good with you know, we supported Ramones quite often, and even people like Tom Petty and Robin Trower. You know, we should have maybe got back and played, you know, played to our strengths and done another tour. But I think we missed the boat there as well. So to a certain extent, we failed to take our opportunities.
Oh, I love the Thriller album. I think it's great. I think it was a great follow-up to Life on the Line.
And that's very kind of you to say so. I'm happy that somebody, you know, a few people like the album, and you know, we did our best.
I push it on a lot of people. I've told a lot of people over the years, you know, you gotta hear Thriller. It's almost as good as Life on the Line. You know, it was a good follow up to that record. It's funny that, you know, a couple years later, Michael Jackson comes out with his album called Thriller and kind of stole your album title there.
Well, yeah. I mean, how can you beat plagiarists? I mean, just because you could dance a bit.
Yeah, but you know, you said before that Starry Eyes was just, the records were just, I mean, it you really can hear it too, that Do Anything You Want to Do is just almost like a template for what I mean. Starry Eyes, yeah, I hear both songs in my head, and you could totally hear how Starry Eyes is almost a rewrite of Do Anything You Want to Do.
Yeah, I mean, Will never apologize to me for that, Will Birch, but I forgive him.
Yeah, I talked to Will a few weeks ago, actually. But
funnily enough, John, what was his name?
John Wicks.
John Wicks. Yeah, I met him a few years back over in L.A., and he you know, we. Had a lot of time for each other. I liked John. He was a nice guy. It was a great shame, great loss.
Yeah,
that he was cruelly taken from us. And he said that Will said he played Do Anything You Want to Do. He said, rewrite that bloody thing. I want a copy. I want a rewrite of that. So I was mollified.
I don't know how aware you are of kind of the power pop cult, that it's kind of a cult thing where there's several books written about it, and there's always like lists and there's lots of fans and collectors, and you know, it's funny that both Do Anything You Want to Do and Starry Eyes are going to be included on any chronology of power pop or any list of the classic power pop songs, or if they made a box set, both those songs are, you know, they're considered classics of the genre. Both of them are.
To a certain extent, I might claim I invented power pop, but I didn't really. It's always been there. I mean, the Yardbird Shapes of Things was a power pop song.
Yeah, well, a lot of power pop was a throwback to the 60s.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, The Who invented it, power pop.
But Eddie and the Hot Rods and Life on the Line, is that it holds this really weird position in kind of the where everything was at the time, and you know, what was going on before and after. It's just a weird spot in the development of all that different of punk and new wave and power pop and all of that.
Sure. I mean, the thing was, for a songwriter who's a musician, who plays in a band, what you write tends to be influenced by the style of the band, and vice versa. What the songwriter writes influences the way the band plays. And when I joined the Hot Rods, it would be quite obvious that from the first album to the second album, there was quite a marked transition between straight harmonica-based R&B and more melodic, not hard rock, because that's a totally another thing, more riff-based thing anyway. But, you know, it's fast, popular, melodic, and whatever. I mean, so power pop, yeah, that was the junction between the two.
For someone like me, who's a record collector and music fan, who's looking back on all of this, it seems like Do Anything You Want to Do and Life on the Line are historically significant and pretty influential and important in the timeline. That's what it seems like looking back on it, at least.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I'm very pleased that it's managed to reach so many people and so many people think kindly of it. Mm-hmm. Which is basically what you record songs for anyway. It's for people to enjoy. And I'm glad that people enjoy it and have enjoyed it and will continue to enjoy it.
It's a classic. It's a rare thing in a lot of ways. And the people who know that record know that it's a classic of the time, you know, so.
Very kind of you to say so. I mean, you know, if anybody ever said, what was your best vinyl record, I'd probably have to say Life on the Line. And, you know, Do Anything You Want to Do might be my best ever song. There are one or two other good ones, though, that I've managed to write.
What's interesting about you is, since you go back to the Kursaal Flyers,
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking about, it seems like it kind of went from pub rock to new wave and punk, and then power pop kind of on the other side of that, right?
Kind of. Are you talking about my activity or the scene in general?
I guess the scene in general, yeah.
Well, I wrote a book a few years ago called No Sleep Till Canvey Island, which was or is about the pub rock scene. And towards the end, it obviously goes off and starts talking about Stiff Records, for example.
Right.
Nick Lowe and Dury, all those kind of artists, Dr. Feelgood, who all came out of the pub rock scene, but all went into what can be described as sort of new wave slash punk, slightly, but not punk rock as in the Sex Pistols, but perhaps more, a bit more down to earth, maybe some of the early groups, you know, I don't know, like the MC5 maybe, the Stooges, more than the then new punk groups. But punk really shook things up here in London. I mean, I know there was a scene in New York at CBGB's with the Ramones and Talking Heads, etc. But in London, the pub scene continued, but it was past its heyday. You know, if you take the peak of that punk pub rock scene, I guess the peak year was probably 1974, when Dr. Feelgood really broke through. That's when my group, the Kurzweil Flyers, started playing, and Nick Lowe's group, Brinsley Schwartz, broke up. And then shortly after, Enduri's group, Kilburn and the High Roads, broke up. So by early 75, a lot of those groups were no longer. And then sort of in the slipstream of pub rock came the punk thing. And of course, it was musically entirely different. I'm not suggesting there was a similarity of music or even attitude, but what there was, there was an infrastructure had been established, you know, whereby the incoming punk groups could sort of take advantage of this, well, certain parts of the pub rock scene in London that had been set up in the previous few years. And the pub rock revolution really was that it brought the artists closer to the audiences, and because they were playing in sweaty little dives, and it also brought the artists closer to the music, rock music media, because all of the, you know, the writers from the music magazines of the day that were incredibly influential, big circulations, got to meet the artists face to face in a tiny pub. So it was a complete revolution as a sort of antidote to the arena circuit, you know, and prog rock and all of that. So it was a big change. But musically, I think after the Kurzweil Flyers broke up, I'd met John Wicks, who was a late member of the Kurzweils. He came in at the last minute on rhythm guitar, did about 3 or 4 months of touring with us, and then we broke up. And John had co-written a song with our singer, Paul, written the melody. Paul had written the lyrics. And I'm more of a lyric writer, you know, looking for someone to write with. And John had written this fantastic song. It was called Moral Fibre. And I thought, it sounded like The Move. I thought, wow, this is good. So John and I started writing, and then we started looking around for musicians and to form what became the Records. So I suppose musically influences by this time, John was a big fan of Badfinger and the Beatles, obviously. Jerry Rafferty, he liked Steeler's Wheel. I was obviously loved, you know, Big Star and the Raspberries. And of course, Badfinger. So that was our sort of inspiration, those acts I've just named. And also at that time, Cheap Trick were becoming very popular. They were very good as well. So that was our kind of musical target, if you like, that we followed, you know.
Right, yeah.
I don't know if that explains how we kind of came about, but. And of course, the London pub scene was still going strong. So actually, you know, punk rock had kind of come and gone, really, on the street level, because although there were a lot of people walking around still with safety pins through their noses and spiky hair, which was great and really an exciting scene, the punk groups frizzled out fairly quickly. I mean, The Clash when I was in the Kersal Flyers in 76, we had the Clash open for us at quite a big venue in London. And when they walked in the building, we were sound checking, and the minute they walked in, you know, I sensed there was something happening, something new was coming along. The Clash went on to big things, of course, in America, etc. But a lot of the really early groups, like the Sex Pistols, they were broken up by the time we got the records going. Sex Pistols had kind of fizzled out, so yeah. Some of those groups didn't really last. Damned went on for a while, Buzzcocks, I suppose. But I loved that music, and I loved the punk scene. I loved going to the shows, and I loved the look of it. But it kind of killed it for the Kersal Flyers, because we made our money on the college circuit. We went out for pretty good money, and suddenly, you know, you got the Damned throwing custard pies at each other, and the people booking the shows, the social secretaries who were in the students' unions, would, oh, let's have the Damned, you know, they're half the price and twice the fun. So that's what kind of happens to us. But I was going to say that when the records got going, the pub scene in London still existed, so that's where we kind of cut our teeth, at those very same venues like the Hope and Anchor, Dingwall's nightclub, and a few other venues, you know. And we got going in 78, so I don't know if you want to know what happened next, but I can tell you.
Well, yeah, I do, but I guess I have a couple of questions.
Yeah, sure.
Well, so the records, you were never really, because I was wondering if the records were started out as maybe within the punk scene, but you were never really trying to do that.
No, we didn't. We weren't in that scene. I mean, yeah. Apart from anything else, I was quite a bit older than Sid Vicious and, you know, people like that.
Yeah.
By that stage, I was about 30 or getting on to 30. I'd been playing in groups for 15 odd years. No, we didn't aspire to be punk rock at all. But it's interesting how a lot of the music at the time translated when it crossed the Atlantic, because the US audience, obviously the US was a big market for music and record sales. And with respect, apart from certain pockets, you know, of New York, LA, where you'd expect, so you've got magazines like Bomp and the one that was in LA, the name I forget for the moment, but those New York Rocker, those kind of magazines, they were quite hip to everything. But the great mass of America, especially in middle America, were fairly slow to pick up on all these developments. So we tended to get bundled together, you know. It was, and I suppose the term new wave kind of came out of that thinking. It's not quite punk, it's a bit like punk. They got short hair and they play 3-minute songs, but they're a bit more melodic. So let's call it new wave. And then groups like the Cars came along, and as I say, Cheap Trick, you know, what was the other lot? The Knack, you know, My Sharona. There was a scene going on there, and we fell into that, which was good for us. And we didn't mind being bunched together.
So you, like you said, so both Big Star and Cheap Trick, like, so how did you get into Big Star at that point? Because they were really, they weren't very well known at all.
Well, I had all my life been a fairly avid reader of music media, you know, rock weeklies or monthlies or whatever. Certainly I was in those days. And in London, in the UK, we had two or three very influential publications. The main one, I suppose, was New Musical Express, or NME. It was a weekly. It had some really cool writers on it who really had their ear to the ground. And they would maybe go to New York, or they'd visit CBGBs, they'd come back, they'd write about television or Talking Heads or Patti Smith. And I used to just follow it like mad, and just bought loads of records, went to gigs all the time. So I probably read about Big Star and Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone I used to subscribe to fortnightly. So I was reading about all that stuff and keen to hear the music. I'd buy the records would come out on import. So it'd be the American pressings would be in those days, an album, an LP, retail price in London was about £2. Was that $3 or something? But for another pound, for £3 or so, you could get an import. And so even the big acts, not Bob Dylan or anyone like that, but certainly bands like Cheap Trick, their albums would come out on import maybe 2 months before they got the official UK release. So I had to have it the minute it was available. So I was buying loads of these records, just listening to them. I also had a friend, Paul Bradshaw, his name is, who gave me what I suppose kids today call a mixtape, so a cassette. You know, you put together a cassette, a C90 of about 25 or 30 tracks. I don't think the term power pop was used, but it was certainly that. It was of that genre. Mm. And most of it I was aware of, but some of it I wasn't. And that tape I played to death, and that, you know, I discovered quite a lot of other sort of more obscure US groups from that little mixtape. So ear to the ground, you know, used to put myself about, and, you know, which I kind of think is what it's all about, really, being a fan, first and foremost. So that was my introduction to those groups like Big Star and Cheap Trick.
Makes sense. I think the first two Big Star albums were reissued as a double album in like 78, and that was in Europe, I think, right? So
I don't remember that. I mean, I had them, I've still got them on Advent, Big Star and Radio City.
Wow.
I've still got the behind me here on the shelf, the 12-inch. I don't recall them being bundled, but then, of course, Big Star 3 came out, which was obviously a tricky one, you know, by comparison. But the first two, great records, loved them. But what happened with the records was that we'd been playing around the pubs in London in the middle of 78, and then we got a phone call from Stiff Records, who were going to be putting a new tour together, UK tour, 8 weeks, and it was touring the UK by train. That was the gimmick. They hired a railway train from British Rail, booked it for 6 or 8 weeks, and we went everywhere on the train. So five bands. We weren't on Stiff. Well, what happened was John and I had written a song which was covered by Rachel Sweet on her first album on Stiff. That's how we kind of got to know Rachel. And Stiff said, Rachel's looking for a backing group for the Stiff tour. Do you fancy doing it? So we said, well, we'll think about it. Sort of being a bit big time. And we phoned back and said, we'll do it if we can have our own spot on the show. You know, very, very pushy, really. And they said, sure. So every night on the Stiff tour, we got to open with four of our own songs before Rachel came on. And then also on that tour, you had Jonah Louie, Reckless Eric, Lena Lovitch, and Mickey Jupp. So that there were the five main Stiff acts, plus the records kind of trailing along. And we'd also written a song called Starry Eyes, which American listeners, some might know, because that was our best-known song, I guess. We'd recorded Starry Eyes, and halfway through the Stiff tour, we had a couple of days off, and we went back to London and mixed it. And then Virgin Records were getting interested in us, and they eventually signed us. But they put Starry Eyes out as a kind of a faux 45 on our own label. You know, it was on the record company or something, which was a little sort of joke, but it was actually, you know, pressed and distributed by Virgin. But also halfway through the tour, and there's an entourage of 50 people on this train with all the roadies and the crew and everything. We had a day off, and we were all instructed to go home and get our passports. And, you know, we got very excited about this. And next thing we know, we're going to New York to play several nights at the Bottom Line Club in the December of 78, which was, I'd never been to the States before. None of us had. It was incredibly exciting. And by the time we got to New York in the December, we had the copies of Starry Eyes 45, you know, pressed up. So we obviously took a box with us. and started handing them out to everybody we met backstage at the Bottom Line. And some of them were radio people. And the next thing we know, WNEW in New York is playing Starry Eyes Over the Air as an import disc. And then one of the little record shops in Greenwich Village bought a small quantity and selling it. So that's how the, you know, and then I think I did an interview with Rolling Stone. And it gradually gained momentum. But that Stiff tour was very, very handy for us, getting us to New York, you know.
Yeah. I wonder if you could tell the story of what you remember about writing Starry Eyes, because it's become such an iconic power pop song at this point.
Well, John and I, we had a rehearsal studio that we hired in East London. And the guys who were in the group, who at that point were Phil Brown on bass and Hugh Gower on guitar, you know, the four of us would rehearse there. But John and I used to get there early, get an hour ahead to sort of work on, although we could sit around at home writing songs with an acoustic guitar, there was nothing like getting a drum kit and an amplifier out. So the two of us would just spend an hour kicking ideas around. And this idea we had, well, actually it started with the tune that John wrote. So usually the songs would start with the lyrics and I would give John the lyric and he'd put a tune to it. But this one was the other way around. He had a tune and we didn't have any words. It was very similar, and John, the late John, sadly, won't mind me saying this, that it was quite similar to Eddie and the Hot Rods' record, Do Anything You Want to Do, which had been a recent hit, which was a great record. So we were kind of inspired, or John was inspired by Do Anything You Want to Do for the tune to Starry Eyes on the chords, I think. So he would sing and I would whack the drums and he'd go, da, 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 you know, dimmy, dimmy, do, di, 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 boo, boo, boo. No words at all. We whacked it down onto a cassette tape and I took it home to put words to it. And I didn't know, you know, what it was going to be. I think we had some silly names for the song for a little while. Demoed it with silly lyrics, I think. I can't remember really. But around that time, we had a manager, I think it was our first manager, who was trying to get us a record deal. This is a while before we signed to Virgin. And I, because the Kurzweil Flyers had been on CBS or Columbia Epic, as it's known in America, when the Kurzweil Flyers broke up, as is normal, they retained us individually under contract should we go on to something new. And so CBS had the first option on the records and, in fact, put us in the studio to do demos. We did Teenorama. We did about three or four songs for them, but they didn't pick us up. So I was out of the contract and Virgin was sniffing around. And the manager we had, get back to the manager, we had a little TV show lined up, an independent TV thing in London. We were on telly ages before we had a record deal. And the manager, the crucial point of the negotiation, he went on vacation to France for 2 weeks. And when he got back, he was no longer our manager because we figured, perhaps a bit harsh really, but that he sort of lacked commitment. You know? Yeah. We thought going on vacation was incredibly square in those days. You know? He probably had family. I mean, now I'd go on vacation, you know, but. but anyway, he went on vacation, and that bit in it, while you were lost in France, he was stranded in the British Isles, left to fall apart amongst the passports and the files. That was me, you know, imagining his office where he was supposed to be. All our contracts were in there, and but the minute that Virgin wanted to talk, I think it was Virgin, or maybe it was getting out of the CBS deal. I can't remember. Anyway, some crucial point in the business side of things, off he went. And when he came back, we were gone. So that whole lyric was really about that experience. A bit juvenile, really. But that's kind of, you've got to kind of put that head on to write those kind of songs. You've got to feel a bit bitter and twisted for half an hour, you know, to give you the angst to write Get Me Out of Your Starry Eyes and Be on Your Way. You know, and he was gone. Then we found out, then we got our second manager, but that's a whole other story. So that's how that song came about.
Yeah, anything works for inspiration, right? That's what you, as long as you, you've got some seed.
So most of those record songs, you know, did start with the lyrics, but John was very adept at putting terrific melodies, you know, and also he's very good at arranging harmonies. And the other guys were good players as well. We were a good little group for a year or two, you know. After the Stiff tour, we were now signed to Virgin and we're going to make our first album. And we don't get Todd Rundgren and we don't get Tom Werman, but we do get Mutt Lange, who went on to become one of the most famous producers in the world. He just, when he met us, he just finished that huge album by, well, what's that heavy metal group he produced? AC/DC, yeah, the big one that broke them through in 78, 79.
Highway to Hell.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. He just not really our cup of tea, although we had, when they first came to London, ACD played on what was then the pub rock circuit, and they had a residency at this tiny pub in Kensington. I saw them there. This is about maybe around the time their first record came out, and they have got a bit of a following, but they come over from Australia. But anyway, Matt had produced AC/DC, and then he'd moved on to us. And we went in the studio with him, and we started recording what became our first album, The Records, it was called in the States. Here we called it, what did we call it? We called it something else.
Shades
in Bed. Yeah, that's right. Thank you. And Matt was only going to produce. He was going to be the what you might call the executive producer, but he'd only be hands-on in the studio on four songs, and he would select the four. He presumably selected the four he thought would be potential 45s, and then his engineer, a guy called Tim Freese Green, who I knew anyway because he'd engineered some of the Kurzweil Flyers stuff a couple of years later. Tim kind of took over on production on the other seven or eight songs. But it was a good team, and we were in the studio for, it seemed like ages. I mean, I suppose it went on over 6 weeks, 8 weeks or something of, you know, overdubbing, mixing, the whole bit. We recorded a single, Rock and Roll Love Letter, cover of the Tim Moore song, great song, which the Bay City Rollers had also had a hit with, I believe, in the States. They put that out as a 45, but it bombed, so it was taken off the album. But Matt did get involved and start a remake of Starry Eyes, which is a different recording to the one on the 45. In fact, on the UK Shades in Bed album is the remake, but for the American, The Records album, they put the original on, as you might know that. Tina Rama, Affection Rejected was another one. Anyway, Matt did a few songs and Tim did the remainder.
Thank you.
And it all worked really, really well, you know. Matt was very skilled in the studio. Tim, they both were. Then we get an offer to tour the UK opening for The Jam. Now, I suppose The Jam, in a way, fall into this musical style in a way. I mean, they were influenced, I guess, by The Who. Very, very melodic kind of up-tempo poppy rock songs. They were terrific. You know, we did a lot of dates with them. I'm jumping the gun a bit here, but then suddenly we get our first US tour crops up. You know, the album's coming out in America. And hey-ho, boys, you're going to the USA for 8 weeks. That was fantastic. And just wonderful experience, really. And the records, you know, the single Full 45 of Starry Eyes started going up the chart in music. Oh, was it Cashbox and Billboard and all that? And the radio stations were playing it. And the album, God of 41 on the Billboard, which doesn't sound very good, but it's not bad for a debut. There is a very interesting story about records that get to 41, but I'll save that for another day. there are a lot of them, by the way. anyway,
oh, because it's just outside the top 40, is that?
Yeah, the top 40 is the what you might call the ambition, isn't it? To reach that's the golden top 40. It doesn't really matter if you got the 39 or 6, top 40. And if you can't be top 40, you're kind of not in the game. And anyway, moving swiftly on. we loved, you know, we absolutely loved playing in the USA. We went coast to coast. We worked nearly every night. It was fantastic. We did, what had happened was Virgin Records would, on a new distribution deal with Atlantic, and our LP was the first one released under that pact. So consequently, we got huge push. I mean, every day, I'm not exaggerating, every day would consist of at least, apart from a show, a sound check and a show, 4 days out of five would be a show. Every day would consist of at least two radio station visits, local radio, at least two local press interviews, at least one phoner with Australia or somewhere, and at least one in-store appearance where we go and sign stuff and meet fans every day. It was relentless, and it was just fantastic. And we felt we were getting the real push, you know. So far, so good, as it were. And that was that. Then what happened? We came back to the UK, and there'd been a few ups and downs on the tour, personnel-wise. But, hey, you know, it was a band that stays together, plays together, whatever the expression is. Everything was good. We got a European tour with Robert Palmer, opening for Robert Palmer, which was very good, except that halfway through the tour, one member of his family got ill, and he had to abandon the tour and go back to the Bahamas or wherever he lived. So that we only did about 4 or 6 dates in Sweden, Netherlands, I think. We were meant to go to Germany anyway. So, but during that tour, there was a rub really between Hugh, the guitar player, and the rest of the group, which I won't go into. But basically, when we came back from the Robert Palmer tour, Hugh left the group. Maybe it was a mistake. I don't know. He was such a great guitar player. Really, really good. What happens with it's the classic, isn't it? What happens with groups is, I mean, there's hardly any groups in the world, the four-piece or five-piece groups, that have more than two songwriters. You know, I'm talking now about people who can actually sit down and write a tune and finish it and present it and it gets recorded.
Right.
You know, the Beatles had three. I mean, that was taking the mickey a bit, really, three songwriters. But you very rarely get two people. And so what tends to happen is those who aren't natural songwriters either just kind of suck it up and shrug their shoulders and hope to get something of theirs recorded, which does happen, or they want to contest the position and you know, anyway, that without going into detail, I think you know what I mean. And yeah. And that story, you know, of nearly every four-piece rock band in the world until groups like, I believe, I don't know for fact, but REM and U2 split the Dosh four ways, you know.
Yeah.
And that's why U2 are probably still together and REM still were together for a long time. So people can't bitch about, oh, the songwriters are making all the money, which is kind of unfair because you've got to go out on the making the records one thing. When you go out on an American tour for 8 weeks, it's a lot of work. And if you're only getting, you know, $100 a day or whatever the run rate was, and the songwriters are getting, you know, royalties, it creates an imbalance within the group. But, hey, that's what happened, you know. Okay, so now Virgin pick up their option for album number 2. John and I have written a bunch of songs, which become an album called Crashes. We don't have a lead guitarist, so we go into rehearsals with a friend of ours called Barry Martin, who is a late member of the Kurzel Flyers also, and we routine 10 or a dozen songs for a few weeks. On the big American tour, we were in Toronto. We're hanging out with a Canadian girl group called the B-Girls, sort of friends. And they were being produced by a guy called Craig Leon. And I knew the name Craig Leon because he produced the early albums by Moon Martin, who I liked. We met Craig in Toronto and he expressed interest. So he came over to London. And Virgin hired him to produce the Crashes album. So we were looking for a lead. Barry wasn't going to join the group full time. So we're looking for a lead guitarist / harmony singer. And I think Craig, I can't remember, he said, well, this Jude Cole guy is pretty good. I'd seen Jude in Moon Martin's band in London the previous year at the Marquee Club. And I remembered him, and God, I thought he was great. He was 19 at the time, 19. We were about 30 at the time. The rest of the guys were in their late 20s. And this guy was sort of 10 years younger. Anyway, he got on a plane, came to London. We did a few rehearsals. He was fantastic. So he joined the sessions with Craig for this Crashes album. We'd written all the songs. I mean, there would have been three songwriters in the group. That to completely scotch what I just said a minute ago, because Jude's a great songwriter. But the songs had been written. So Jude played guitar, overdubbed solos, and did the harmonies with John. Just beautiful. That was good. And we got on really well with Jude. Then the Crashes is scheduled for release. And the next American tour is set up, 1980. Whereas our first album, Shades in Bed / The Records, had been our first album under the Virgin Records Atlantic Pact, 12 months later, that business arrangement had broken down. And Crashes was, I believe, the last album under the Virgin Atlantic Pact.
Thank you.
So whereas in the previous year we were doing, you know, 6 interviews a day and an in-store and all the rest of it, suddenly, you know, we're doing like 7 interviews in 5 weeks. I mean, there was nothing. There was hardly any promotion. You know, the first time when we get off the plane at JFK, there's the 2 limos to meet us. Laid on by the record company. And we come into town and we pull up outside the old Gramercy Park Hotel, and there's people on the sidewalk asking for autographs. I mean, I'm afraid my cynic-o-meter did go off when I saw that. I thought it was a bit of a setup, but hey, it made us feel good, you know. A year later, we get to JFK and we put on the little bus, you know, that takes you from the terminal to the station. It's like complete opposite, you know. But, you know,
so
the trip was good, you know. But anyway, the dream was, I mean, Virgin had a go, but they didn't have the artillery in place that they'd had the previous year.
Are you implying that the record company would hire people to ask you for autographs?
No, sure. So why,
that's
why
hilarious.
Why wouldn't you? You know, give him a bag of popcorn and a Coca-Cola. Hey, you know, some kid on the pavement. Hey, you doing anything? Stand here. And when this car pulls up and these 4 limeys get out, run up to them and ask them to sign your newspaper or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Fantastic, though, isn't it? Isn't it just great? All this stuff, you know, I find it so inspiring. Yes, so the crashes tour, it was okay. I mean, we did pretty good business at the shows because we still had the residual fandom, you know, appreciation from the Starry Eyes of the previous year. So the ticket, the gates were good. I mean, we were doing good business, but the promotion. You know, the radio station, we did a handful. I mean, some of the radio stations and local press we got, I got myself because I'd kept notes the previous year of, you know, who the DJ was at W, whatever it was, and the local, because I made friends with some of these local writers. They were great. They were fans, you know, and they were good guys, and we'd exchange postcards and things. So, but anyway, we did the tour. The tour wound up in Chicago. We played Chicago Fest, which was then an annual sort of 4-day event where big. I think we were on. I think Alice Cooper headlined the night afternoon we were on. I think I didn't see him play, but we stayed at the hotel Holiday Inn. I think opposite the venue in Chicago. It's changed now, by the way. I was down there a couple of years back and. I was trying to find the place where the Chicago Fest took place, but it's been covered with kind of, I don't know, condominiums and cafes and things. But anyway, what happened, we were so fed up after this tour finished in Chicago because they cut the tour short by a couple of weeks. We were due to go out the coast and we didn't go. And I think I may have redecorated my hotel room after a couple of sherbets. But anyway... It was the end. And Jude, who lived in, where did Jude live then? LA, I think. He went back home to LA. We went back to London. And that was pretty much the end, you know, of the records, except for the fact that Virgin Records, bless them, picked up their option for yet another album, a third album, which was unheard of, but they did. So we stayed together a little longer.
Yeah, and you got a singer, like a lead singer, right?
Well, Chris, lovely guy, good singer, does a good Robin Zander kind of vocal. We were under pressure, you know. When things don't work out, people look around for reasons, don't they? They look around. Oh well, if only that had been the single, or if only. You hadn't have done that show in Central Park with the cars, or if only you had a front man. And this was the thing, get a front man, you'll be stars, you know. I don't know, the agent or the record company or the public, somebody, our manager, I don't know, somebody's saying, get a front man. So we did. And, you know, we tried it. We made the album. The songs on that are not, I don't think, very, very strong. And if you listen to the the words, if you can bear to, they were all kind of a bit pissed and bitter and twisted and, oh, poor us, you know, poor me, you know. But you know, that was the inspiration behind the songs. A couple of okay songs on there, but it wasn't as strong as the previous two.
It took me years to find that record. I never found it in a record store for years and years, you know.
Well, it was what happened was there was no major distribution deal anymore for, well, certainly for us. I don't know about Virgin Records. I think they went on to, I don't know, after that, I don't know who they went on to, Warner's, I can't remember, but somebody. But they also, by that point, had their own little setup in New York, Virgin something or other, and so they had a little bit of distribution infrastructure there, so they pressed up, I don't know, a few thousand, put it out themselves. And I, years later, in the 90s, I licensed, I set up a little record label and licensed those album, three albums from Virgin, and put them out on compact disc. I think I've got one copy left of In For A Spin, but I think I pressed up a very cautious 500 units. I think I sold most of them, but anyway, yeah.
It wasn't
a very strong record, and then we disbanded. What happened personally to me was around the time we were finishing up making that record, I get a call from Jake Riviera, formerly of Stiff Records, now managing, of course, Elvis Costello, Nick Lowe, and many other people. And he asked me to come and work at his business, looking after Carlene Carter, who was then Nick's wife, you know. Mm-hmm. And I became Carlene Carter's tour manager, which was a fantastic experience, a fantastic eye-opener. As I said, I didn't think that being well, actually, Jake said, well, "How would you like to be Carlene's manager?" I thought, "Well, I'm not gonna get to make any big business decisions or anything like that." I ended up driving the bus, actually, but one night I did sit around a dinner table of eight people with Johnny Cash,
right,
and June Carter in Edinburgh, yeah, and. It was funny. I mean, I'm going off on a tangent now. We're in this crowded dining room in this nice hotel in Edinburgh having dinner. And there's Cash, and Cash is sitting kind of, I mean, quite often with stars, you know, recognizable stars. When you go in a restaurant with them, they always want to sit with their back to the room. I don't know if you've it does happen, you know, because they don't want to be people gawping at them all the time, but
right.
But we were on a big circular table, and Johnny sat, it was a corner table, and Johnny sat in the corner so he could survey the entire room, and two or three tables away was Johnny Cash's band, or about five of them, and they were having a good old drink up, and they were being incredibly noisy. And this is a fairly quiet restaurant, and I'll never forget, Johnny Cash stood up from his seat And he looked over the room, across the room at these five guys. And he just stood there for about 5 or 10 seconds. And he just looked at them. And they completely went quiet and carried on, not making any more. Then he just sat back down again. It was the coolest thing. So I got a lot of interesting experiences working with Carlene and with that whole organization. You know, it's really good fun for 2 or 3 years. Anyway, that was, and then the records we did try and reform once or twice in the 80s or 90s, I think 90s. We did a couple of shows, but it wasn't really there anymore, you know, for us. We rehearsed a lot and worked a set up, and you can imagine we'd Starry Eyes, obviously, and a couple of Bird songs, I seem to recall. But anyway, that was the story of the records, really. And John went to live in America, and he called me up one day and said, look, you know, there's still a lot of appetite for the records over here. And I've been doing some solo shows, acoustic singing our songs are great. You know, he said, do you mind if I go out as the records with some other musicians? I said, no. He said, well, actually, I'll call it John Wicks on the records so as to sort of differentiate. I said, fine. And he did until, sadly, died a couple of years ago. But through the 90s and noughties, he did a fair bit of work putting, you know, keeping the name alive, as it were, mainly on the West Coast, I think. And I went over there 2 or 3 times, you know, had dinner with him, and this was more recently. And John was a great guy. Yeah. And Phil had died as well. So, you know, there we are.
Well, his father always told him he was born the losing kind, and asked him when he'd leave behind the nighttime world he lived for in his mind.
Now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
It looks like your luggage is over 50 pounds. Is there anything you can take out?
Oh, yeah. Let me just toss all these $20 bills.
Great. Let me grab you a trash can.
Stop. Instead of throwing money away, move some clothes into a carry-on. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.